Hello and welcome to Travel Genius. I'm Mark Elwood.
And I'm Nikki Eckstein. We're the Travel Geniuses.
Yes, we are. This week, we will be flipping our usual script and telling you something we almost never do. We're not to go.
Plus, we'll be joined by Philippe Cousteau, who, as his last name might imply, knows the world almost as comprehensively underwater as he does on dry land, a claim neither one of us can really make for ourselves.
He'll be telling us about the unusual purposes he finds in everyday travel objects, like his watch, the most purposeful lies a traveler can tell, and a particularly spicy travel tip.
All that and more on this week's episode of Travel Genius. All right. Well, before we dive in with our deep diving dignitary, I think we need to address one elephant in the big world of travel right now, which is over-tourism. It's like the opposite of a buzzword. It's something that nobody wants associated with their particular destination. But at the same time, it is literally on everybody's lips within our little industry.
It is a huge issue. It's that terrible phenomenon where places are saturated with crowds. I think Venice is the most synonymous with this, but there are other places like Dubrovnik, which is groaning under the number of people, or Barcelona, Amsterdam. They were economically really eager to welcome tourists, but they forgot about what would happen if all of those tourists came.
Right. So if you build it, will they come? Yes. Now what? It's such an interesting time to talk about this because right now here at Bloomberg, we're compiling our annual Where to Go list for 2019. And that's kind of an annual moment where we tell readers what destinations are going to be trending in the year ahead. And really, for the first time this year, we're thinking also about where not to go. That just seems really equally important in this day and age, both for us writers and for industry folks like the team at Intrepid Travel, which just actually released their own list for the first time.
I think it is something very interesting about the idea of responsible tourism. Venice has done this very badly because it's made people feel guilty for visiting and scolded people. Other destinations have reminded us that we should think about where and when and how we travel. Amsterdam is doing this very well with a digital program to sort of nudge travelers out of the center of town and explore other parts of the city. And it also had a video link that you could check on the tourism website to see how long the lines were outside major museums. So you could see in advance it's a 2-hour wait. So I think we want to try and find ways to travel and go the place we want to, but in a good way.
Absolutely. And I think for us that are inside this industry and want to promote for people to travel and understand the amazing impact that travel can have on all of our lives and on the world in general, it's just so important to focus on these things in order to make sure that we're having the right impact on both the planet and the people who live in these places. So, Mark, with that, I'm going to tell you the first place that I'm not going to go in 2019.
Let's pause for a second. So, this is you're going to talk about somewhere to tell people not to go, just in case people. And let's explain why we're telling them. We're not, if you do go, it's okay. We're not going to punish you, but we're going to explain why it's better you go somewhere else.
Right. So the first place that I'm going to tell people not to go, you actually can't go, right? The Thai government has actually closed down Maya Bay, which is one of its most famous beaches. It was made iconic in the Leonardo DiCaprio movie, The Beach, which literally catapulted it to the top of so many people's bucket lists. But there has been this horrible recent history of party boats just kind of littering the entire atmosphere, both on land and the coral reefs and marine ecosystems. The Thai government tried to mitigate this by closing that beach for 4 months.
And too late. Let's remember, if they had thought about this just after the movie came out, there could have been more management. But the problem was the intervention came too little too late, right?
It was too little too late. The land, the sea did not rebound in 4 months' time. It was not enough. So now they have closed it for good, so you cannot go there. And my alternative for 2019 is a little known beach destination in Vietnam called Koh Nan and Anantara, which is kind of one of these amazing hoteliers that has a great history for building sustainable, responsible resorts in Asia. They're opening in Koh Nan, Vietnam, and that's going to be my pick.
I think it's interesting. I have friends who live in Hong Kong who have always sworn by the beaches of Vietnam as an overlooked place to have a beautiful, very isolated tropical getaway. It's easy to get to Thailand, package deals. But if you just make a little bit more effort, you're probably going to get what you picture in your mind that it's harder to find in Thailand now.
Similar landscapes, much fewer crowds.
Exactly. We're also, I think, Intrepid was talking about Ubud in Bali, and Bali's a very interesting conundrum. When I went to Ubud, I was startled at how brassy it was. For a place that was so associated with medicine, the name derives from the Balinese word for medicine and spiritual and craftsman. And it really was like walking through Times Square with souvenir stalls and trees instead of skyscrapers.
So sad.
And it was really poorly managed. There was no sense of magic. The Eat, Pray, Love experience, which is what put it so much on the international circuit, really, again, had the wrong kind of impact. And I thought it was very interesting that Intrepid suggested Komodo, which is another island, but very, very, very similar, very nearby. But again, people forget it's there. So you have a real chance to have that tropical Indonesian Balinese feeling without tens of thousands of Australians. And Australian listeners, I apologize, but you and I both know Bali is a bit of a weekend package getaway, and it's not where you want to go for a relaxing vacation.
Plus, Komodo's got incredible snorkeling and diving, if that's your thing.
Does it?
It really does. Yeah, and you can find really interesting liveaboard companies that will take you there, and you can just sail around the islands, which is something that I've always thought sounded super romantic. I'll take you in one more direction that is completely opposite to the two that we've both named, so that we can stop hating on Asia for just like a hot second for over-touristing their destinations. But, you know, Machu Picchu is one of those places that everybody wants to get to in their life. And the Peruvian government every year threatens to reduce or fully stop issuing permits to Machu Picchu because the foot traffic is actually really imperiling the site overall. It is a phenomenal place. If you've had the chance to go, you won't regret it. But there's something to be said about another destination that's really just in the shadow of Machu Picchu, and it's called Choco Caidao. And it's a mouthful, but it's actually a bigger lost Incan city. And the only reason people don't know about it is because the Peruvian government didn't invest in buses or trams to get you to the top of that mountain until this year.
So in other words, you can be a pioneering tourist doing it the right way, so we prevent over-tourism in where? Choco Caidao? I didn't practice this.
That was pretty good,
Choco Caidao? Thank you. I speak Italian, not Spanish.
B plus.
Thank you. That's a little bit of room for improvement. I would also say, we mentioned Venice. I would also, with Venice, I don't think there is an alternative to Venice because there isn't a city that feels exactly like it. But I would remind people, my birthday's in early February, and I've been to Venice for my birthday twice because Venice in the winter is magical.
I was there this February, actually.
Were you?
It snowed. It was the most beautiful experience I had all year.
So this is the thing. I would remind people, you can also think about, if you're dead set on going to a destination, think about going out of peak season. Be the person who helps support the tourism industry when it's quieter, and you might have a different kind of special experience. In Venice, I love it when it rains because it feels like a sort of decaying old ruin, and you hear the drip, 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 and you sit in a cafe drinking Prosecco. I think that's more magical than when it's sunny.
Oh, and everything gets reflective. It really is beautiful. So yes, Mark, I agree with you. Go in the off season, help people make their seasonal business a year-round business. Also, go to the lesser known place, spread the economic benefit of tourism to all of the different parts of a country that don't normally see it. You will be thankful. You will be embraced by those people. And you will see something that has not been littered all over your Instagram feed.
And we're going to talk to our guest today about Venice. So I feel like that's a theme of this podcast. He is someone who knows a thing or two about pristine ecosystems because his name is Philippe Cousteau. He's the grandson of the ocean mapping legend Jacques. And he's the co-founder of Earth Echo International, which is an environmental nonprofit. It aims to inspire young people to work on sustainability. And he also travels the world filming documentaries. I mean, he has the best life filming documentaries, Sumatra, coast of Africa. He goes everywhere.
Philippe's latest show on the Travel Channel is Caribbean Pirate Treasure, which he actually shoots it with his wife, former E! News host Ashlyn Cousteau. And together they investigate the stories of lost plunder around the Caribbean. I mean, how cool is that?
I feel like the seven-year-old me wants that job.
It's amazing. So it's now in its second season. And his other show, because that wasn't enough, Awesome Planet, is in its fifth season, streaming online and airing on local Fox stations and major markets, probably somewhere near you. Let's bring him in. Philippe, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to Travel Genius.
Thanks for having me.
And before we dive in, there is one procedural rule you're going to need to know. Since you're on Travel Genius, we're hoping to get some truly genius tips from you. And whenever we get one, you will hear a sound. What sound will he hear? That is, thank you, Nikki, that is our famous hotel bell. So no pressure,
okay.
But we will be tallying your genius score at the end of the episode.
Oh. Don't worry, we'll report back at the end and let you know how you've done compared to everyone else.
Pressure's on. All right.
Let's dive in with our first question. Philippe, I know that you have this kind of funny tradition of always using the bathroom when you're traveling in a developing country, but specifically before you're about to eat at a restaurant. Can you kind of walk us through this strange tradition that you've got going on?
Well, it's just, it's always a good indicator, I think, of hygiene in a place is when you go in and you kind of survey the restroom space. In case there's any emergencies during the meal, particularly if you're eating things that might be unusual or that you might not be used to, always good to have a clear
path. Do you try to do a little scoop of the kitchen on your way over?
If I'm feeling brave, because there's been some pretty horrible situations where I've walked past the kitchen and I've been like, we're out of here.
Where have you been? Tell us the story of the restaurant you walked into and you thought, that looks fine. And then when you used your little ritual of eye on the kitchen, eye on the bathroom, you thought, I'm out of here.
No thanks.
New Orleans.
Really?
Actually, New Orleans, New York, honestly, pretty much everywhere. I've gone, I'll go along and take just a look in the kitchen. And if you notice that there's like dirtiness all over the floor and bits of food and that, especially if it's lunchtime, they're just open and it's already really dirty. And you notice that there's oil and grease all over the backsplashes and that, that's not a good sign, particularly with pests and things like that. If there's a lot of food underneath the counters or food underneath, the oven or things that you can just kind of see when you look in the kitchen, that kind of bad hygiene is definitely an issue.
It's so interesting because I was very much expecting you, this is my own tendency kind of revealing itself here, but I thought that you were going to give us an example in a third world country or something. In some ways, I think we fool ourselves into these traps of believing that third world countries are less sanitary in some ways than places like New York. I feel like that might actually be completely untrue.
It happens everywhere. I mean, that's to your point, I think it's a misconception that it's only in developing countries or third world countries that, they have less quality standards around hygiene. But it's certainly a problem in every major city in the U.S. and Europe that I've been to, too.
So I want to talk, when we're talking about food, I know you have a sort of secret weapon that you pack to make any tasteless, bland food when you're stuck somewhere taste a whole lot better. Tell us about that and tell us how you worked out how that was a must pack.
So it actually, traveling around the world, you'd be surprised that salt is just not a thing in some places. And I would go to various different countries and want a little bit of salt, a little bit of flavor, and it wasn't there. And so I just started to pack a tiny little camping salt shaker with me. And then my wife, a couple years ago, got me a popcorn maker at home and a thing of truffle salt, which sounds very decadent. To put over that popcorn when we make popcorn at home, because I love popcorn. And I was like, the light bulb went off. I was like, what if I put a little truffle salt in this salt camping container?
So smart.
And put it in my bag, in my suitcase, whenever I'm traveling, in my briefcase. And so wherever I am, I've got just a little taste of something from home.
I agree.
I'm ringing the bell on that because you know what? I use truffle salt as like one of these, like a housewarming present, or if somebody just, got a vacation home somewhere and they really want to build out their kitchen, their spice cabinet, whatever. It's just such an indulgent thing that's actually affordable and easy to find. And I've never thought of traveling with it. I just want to share really quickly, because I learned about this literally today. There's a website that recently launched called Taste Atlas. Mark, has this come on your radar yet?
Not at all.
It's weirdly enough, a Croatian entrepreneur came up with this idea, and they created kind of a network of culinary insiders around the world to recommend all the local dishes from, you know, tiny little towns, whether it's in Italy or Croatia or, you know, wherever else it might be, Zanzibar. And it's this global database of all the local foods that you need to try around the world. So it's something that I'm going to pocket with me for my next trip.
Oh, yes, for sure.
So, okay, Philippe, I'm trying to look at your watch. Listeners can't see this. Hold your watch up for me. It is a Rolex. Because Philippe once told me that he always wears a Rolex when he travels, and I thought it was a Rolex out of the corner of my eye. Why is a Rolex such a great thing to wear when you travel, more than just to tell time?
I have a good friend of mine who is in the military, actually, and he's been a lot of places around the world, and he said some wise words to me a long time ago that, you know, a Rolex is a currency pretty much anywhere. And if you get yourself into trouble and you need to barter your way to a location or catch a ride or something, a Rolex goes a long way to getting you out of a mess. And I think, fortunately, I've never had to use it, but it is something that that is handy to have on you, especially when you're going countries where you might end up in a dodgy situation and need to be able to get out.
Because Rolex is such a recognizable brand.
It is, yeah.
And so it's global currency in the way that a Patek, though it may be a fancier watch, doesn't have the cachet to absolutely everybody.
Absolutely.
I feel like you should get a fake one.
I think you deserve it.
Wow.
I think that was double points.
All right,
one point for Nikki.
Wait, okay. Oh,
then your
Nikki
exit strategy costs a lot less money.
That's true. That's true. That's probably, I'm clearly
not
thinking.
I think that's evil genius, Nikki. Well
that
done.
Is kind of evil genius. I like
that's why
that,
they
Nikki.
Pay us the big bucks, right?
Totally.
Philippe, I really love this about you. You obviously travel the world going to places that a lot of people don't think to go to necessarily, or that don't make it to the top of most people's bucket lists. And in particular, I know that you champion one island in the Caribbean that is close to my heart. So I would love it if you could talk about that a little bit.
Dominica.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, Dominica is an amazing, amazing place. Few people, they oftentimes will confuse it for the Dominican Republic.
Correct.
Very different place. You know, it's a relatively small island, a very volcanic island, and they say that it's the only island that Christopher Columbus would recognize today.
Wow.
Because it's so craggy and mountainous, only about 10 or 20% of the island is actually habitable. The rest is just these incredible volcanic cliffs and steep mountainsides.
Super green.
So it was never cut down for plantations like most of the other islands in the Caribbean. And so it's this verdant, rich jungle everywhere, and it is just a spectacular place. It's a beautiful country. It was devastated by the hurricanes last year. The people are wonderful, and it is, for an adventurer, for a traveler, it's got some, you know, some really wonderful mix of hotels. It's just one of those destinations in the Caribbean that I think is still underappreciated, and thus a gem to be found.
Nick, you wrote about Dominica, didn't you?
Yeah.
And it's rebooting after Irma.
It's so funny because I actually haven't been there, but I reported a story after the hurricane that brought the island so close to my heart, like I mentioned before, because the government has been so kind of forward-looking in its rebound from Irma and Maria last year. And they've set up a task force, if you will, and they're working with all sorts of international agencies to become the first climate-resilient country in the world, and they're defining what that means and how you build smarter and how you protect your infrastructure and your people and your assets. And they're doing all sorts of coral reclamation, which I'm sure, Philippe, you know a lot about. But it's just an incredible effort from such a scrappy small nation.
Mm. Well, it's smart because, you know, you mentioned coral reefs. What a critical ecosystem for absorbing storm surge.
Yes, that's exactly mangroves, their point.
You know, healthy mangrove forests also absorbing storm surge, you know, and the first thing that we like to do, certainly the United States, Florida, is, you know, cut down all the mangroves, build a house or hotel right on the beach, have a barrier island that's called a barrier island because it's a barrier against stuff that's bad.
It's called a barrier island for a reason.
For a reason.
It's not a decorative name.
And so you get Michael and Florence and you get all these problems not coming in. But, you know, it's very smart for Dominica to do that. It's a wonderful place.
It's amazing. I'm just pulling up the statistic now because I couldn't believe it when I first saw this, when I learned this, reporting the story, that when you have healthy coral and healthy mangroves, like you're saying, that can absorb 98% of a wave's energy in a hurricane. 98. I had to pull up my own story and remind myself of that number because you can't believe that that's true. I think we have kind of a shared passion, which is collecting the same type of souvenir wherever we go. For me, it's little elephant figurines, and I believe for you it's masks.
Yes, that's correct.
How did that start?
That started, I was 16 in Papua New Guinea on an expedition.
Which is already
the
beginning of a crazy story. I am much older than 16, and Papua New Guinea would scare the bejesus out of me. How did you end up at 16 in Papua New Guinea?
So an incredible oceanographer, a woman named Dr. Eugenie Clark, known as the Shark Lady. She was one of the first female oceanographers out there. And
anyone
with
a moniker like Shark Lady is a good person
in my book. Is cool, right? And so I had an opportunity to go on a research expedition with her when I was 16. And so we went to eastern Papua New Guinea into a place called Milne Bay, which is still today considered a very dangerous place, Papua New Guinea. And we spent a couple weeks diving off a research vessel, and I was helping her with the research. And it was just my first foray into kind of my legacy of Cousteau and exploration, because I didn't really grow up doing that with my grandfather. He was a little bit older at that time. So that never really happened. So this was my first really kind of adventure into nature and the wilderness and distant foreign places. And I then went back to Port Moresby and spent a couple days. And of course was told, don't leave the hotel. Of course, a 16-year-old, you always have great ideas. And I was like, oh, that's pish posh. I can leave the hotel, no problem. So I left the hotel and went to a lunch at a little place and then walked back. And back then, the State Department warned about groups of gang members or gangs that they called rascals. It doesn't sound like a very dangerous term, but they were known for either knocking you out or killing you before they mugged you because they just didn't want to deal with a fight or an argument.
All right.
And so very violent, very dangerous, and you were warned not to leave your hotel. Again, 16, don't always make great decisions. So I did. I left the hotel, went, had lunch. I was walking back to the hotel, and I remember walking around a corner, and there was this group of three guys sitting on a park bench, and they looked at me, and they looked at each other, and they got up, and they started coming for me. And I was just like, oh, my God. And I turned around and started running back to the hotel. And I ran around another corner and literally bumped into three cops. And they had an Uzi on one shoulder and a shotgun on the other, each of them. And the guys chasing me stopped dead in their tracks and looked at the police and looked at me. The cops looked at me, looked at them, and then looked at me and just kind of smiled. And they were like, you are lucky.
Yeah.
And I was just kept running back to the hotel. And the other guys just walked away. And so from there, I went up to the highlands of Papua New Guinea and to visit with the Huli people. And they had a little shop there that they were hand making artisanal items, and they had a mask. And I decided that I wanted to bring that, and I brought that back home with me as a memory of this trip. And it's become then a tradition ever since.
Your
that we
near
collect
death
masks.
Encounter.
Yes, it kind of reminded me, whew, life is precious. Remember these incredible places. So
I'm slightly hyperventilating.
Yeah.
And that didn't even happen to me.
It was honestly very scary. It was very, very scary. It was the closest. People always say, I'm with crocodiles or sharks, and we're doing incredible documentaries, and we're snakes, and we're doing all these different things, crazy dangerous places. I've never felt threatened by an animal before, from great whites to schools of 100 or a hammerhead. The only time was that time in Papua New Guinea that I thought I was in for it, and it was because of other people. So I always tell people that if you're afraid of animals, be a lot more afraid of people.
Humans more dangerous than animals.
Humans
so
way more dangerous,
isn't it? Yeah. Oh my goodness. But I do, going back to this idea of masks, I do think it's really special when you can find one type of object that transcends different nations and different cultures so ubiquitously. I think that can be a really fun thing, I'm sure, when you look at all of your masks and you see the differences between them and the commonalities at the same time. It makes the world feel small.
It does. I mean, we have a mask from New Orleans, from Venice, from Papua New Guinea. So it is something that's very universal in cultures and spirituality around the world. And we've got a wall with all these masks on it now. And behind is when I got them and where they came from.
Oh, I love that.
That just reminds us of all these adventures.
Mark, do you collect anything from your travels?
No, I don't buy anything
really?
Ever.
Ever.
Because it's just something I'm going to have to dust. I'm not.
Not a duster.
And
no,
you're not home enough to dust.
Nope. Exactly.
So there's that.
Or appreciate that.
How else do you stay connected to your grandfather's legacy? How does it impact the way that you travel?
I remember also in that trip to Papua New Guinea, growing up with my grandfather, he always told me that, no matter who we are, no matter where we live, we're all connected to one another. And that there are these golden threads that unite us. And I remember when I was up in the Highlands, we were visiting a native tribe that was relatively isolated and didn't have much exposure to the West. Certainly, their hunting methods were very traditional. They hunted with bow and arrow and spear. They had grass skirts. They're barefoot, bare-chested, still, depending on what tribe, it was either boar tusks or feathers ornamenting their noses. Lived in, you know, wooden and grass huts. None of the technological conveniences that we take for granted today. And I remember I was walking in a narrow path in a forest, and there was a group of Huli tribesmen walking towards me. And again, bow and arrow, traditional spear, grass skirts, bare-chested, barefoot. And several elder men passed me, and then it kind of went down in age. And I saw a younger teenage kid walking past, grass skirt, barefoot, bow and arrow, spear, but he was wearing a Lakers t-shirt.
Huh.
And I couldn't believe that here we are in one of those remote places in the world, and being from L.A., there was a Lakers t-shirt. And it just reminded me, I could hear my grandfather speaking. So whenever we travel, whenever we go places, we really do try and seek out the authentic experiences. We were in Venice recently, for example, and it's mobbed. I mean, it's really out of control. But all you have to do is go maybe a 10-minute walk into Venice, and it's empty.
Right.
And you get to walk around and see.
I was a tour guide in Venice, and there were always places in Venice that are empty. You just have to get lost. It's
yes,
a place that you
exactly.
must get lost. You can't read a map. Just walk until it's quiet, and it'll still be beautiful. Yes, you want to go to St. Mark's, but you just, there are so many little squares that will be empty, even at the peak, even in peak season.
And we were there, you know, in early September. There was loads of people, still the tour guides and the cruise ships. But that's what I'm talking about, is that, you know, walk and get lost and go into a place and try and experience that connectivity with people and the people that live there, the people that are there. And you'll notice that there are commonalities of humanity that connect all of us.
So I love that, talking about connecting with people and finding a way around a city, you have a great sneaky way for getting brilliant restaurant reservations out of a hotel, even when you're not staying there. And you're looking so sheepish now. People can't see this, but you're looking so sheepish. So come on, fess up. Tell us what you do.
So a good tip, if you don't know where to go, and this I employed recently on a trip to Frankfurt, where I only had about 12 hours in the city, a layover. I went to, I didn't know where to go, and I didn't know, you know, you look on TripAdvisor, something online, and there's 1,000 different recommendations. You don't really know the neighborhood. So I went into a really nice hotel, and I said, went to the concierge, and I said, I've just checked out, and before I go to the airport to go to the, catch my flight, do you recommend any really good little German restaurant nearby? And they're like, oh, yes, of course, sir. You know, and they gave me this great recommendation, this great little town, just this little village next to where we were in Frankfurt, and I was walking 20-minute walking distance, and it was fantastic. So yes, you can benefit sometimes from the wisdom of concierge.
Wait.
Any concierge listening will be like,
but you
what?
Can, you're tipping wait. Them.
Yeah, I give them a, you know.
But you're not staying at this place.
No, I wasn't actually staying.
That's, okay.
Nikki got the look in her eye when she's like, I want to press this bell several times.
No, that is so smart, because I've definitely been in the position where maybe I'm staying at an Airbnb or, you know, whatever it might be. Or maybe I didn't splurge for the 5-star Grand Dame. Work wasn't paying for my travels. But that's using the concierge. White lie that everybody wins from, actually.
Well, yeah, I never said that I was actually I guess that was implied.
Is it
and they just assumed and given him a 5 euros.
Exactly.
Was like,
the concierge,
you know, okay.
wins.
But if you tip him or her, they're winning.
True.
They're giving their knowledge out and getting something for it.
It's very
and
true.
you're not trying to swindle the hotel out of a room. So I actually think that's the perfect white lie.
And if it's a great concierge, maybe you'll stay there next time.
Good
That's
point.
True too.
Just saying.
That's
Any
true.
Concierge just listening, I'd be curious whether they have ways of, if there are tells that people have when they do things like that. Can a concierge tell whether you were staying at the hotel? Do they care?
They can look it up. I've been to a place and they were like, oh, so what room was it?
Mm.
And what was the name? And then it's like, well, actually, I'm here visiting a friend and I don't remember their room number or anything like that. And they'd be like, oh, okay. And, you know.
Oh.
They usually are still helpful, but yeah, sometimes they will quiz you a little bit.
That's
you
a, that's
better
a,
be ready
you've
with
got
a quick,
your
quick
plan
response.
B ready to go.
Yes, you have to have a good quick response.
I also want to know, you have an amazing, you have a map in your office with all the world places you've been, mm-hmm. pins on those. When you look at that map, where does your eye go first? Which pin do you always go back to and why?
Two different places. Paris, because of having grown up going to Paris. I got married in Paris, and it's just always been a connection to that side of my family and that legacy, spending time with my grandfather there. And then Papua New Guinea, because it was such a formative trip and experience for me at 16 to go with Jeannie to, you know, have a near-death experience and to see these tribes people in the jungle and to go diving. And it was really the experience that said, wow, it's like real-life Indiana Jones. This is what I want to do with my life.
Leave us with a little taste of luxury since we've talked about third world dirty restaurants. Let's turn that conversation into a totally different place so that we can end on a nice luxe note and give us your favorite secret spot in Paris since it's a place that's so close to your heart.
So my favorite spot in Paris is not super luxe, but it's a restaurant that has been there for about 70 years. It's the Relais de Venise in Porte Maillot. And it is a place that doesn't take reservations. You have to go and stand in line, and they only serve steak frites. And they just ask you when you sit down how you want it done. You get the house wine. My grandfather went there when it started opening. My father grew up going there. When my mother moved to Paris to marry my father, he stopped there at that restaurant before even taking her back to his apartment when she landed. I grew up going there. So it's just three generations. It's a very, very special place to me. That is my favorite restaurant in the world and my kind of pilgrimage every time I go
to Paris. I love that you said that because we are lucky enough in New York to have two locations of Le Relais de Venise.
Yes, they're,
and actually, our colleague, Kate Crater, who does all of our food content for us, just went and unearthed the most phenomenal ice cream meringue sundae that is like a six-layer concoction. And we have been talking about it all week in the office.
Wow.
So kudos to you for somehow making that feel all the more relevant in my life right now.
It's a great place.
I'm so hungry. But that's how is your French? Are you fluent?
It's a little rusty. Mais c'est pas mal.
Okay. Well, I'm not gonna test you. I was just curious whether when you travel, have you picked up lots of languages or do you manage to travel without being agile in different tongues?
I love languages, and so I speak French. It's a little rusty these days, but I also speak Spanish. And when I go places, I always attempt to learn hello and thank you.
Yes.
You know, there's some universal elements in human nature that I think are getting lost as people have their faces buried in phones and aren't paying attention. But thank you and please goes a heck of a long way in just about any place you've ever been. So I always work to learn hello, please, thank you. Wherever I'm going, learn those words in that language. Ideally, also another drink and where's the bathroom? But if that's too complicated, at least hello, please, and thank you.
Yeah. And where? One last thing. Where are you going next, Philippe? Where's your next jaunt? What exotic locale?
Well, we're headed to Egypt, actually. I'm gonna be going to Cairo and Sharm el Sheikh and into probably Luxor and places like that in November for a conference. But then taking a couple days to go to the Valley of the Kings.
It's never been a better time. So,
yeah. Exactly.
Egypt is a great place. I was there last year as well. And, you know, it's still not nearly as many tourists as you used to have. It still has, they're very hungry for tourists. Everybody there is so gracious, so kind. We had a terrific time there. That's why we're going back. It was just fantastic. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I will look forward to hearing about the mask that you bring back and the Rolex that you keep with you.
Hopefully, yes.
Fake Rolex. But thank you so much, Philippe, and a happy travel.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Nikki, so how did Philippe score? Tally us up.
Well, first of all, I have to say Philippe scored the highest of possible marks for storytelling because I was completely captivated by all of his stories.
Should we give him a bonus for storytelling?
We're going to give him a bonus point for storytelling. So he got 4 points with the bonus point for storytelling, 1 for his amazing suggestion to bring truffle salt everywhere you go, another for always packing a Rolex for the most unusual purpose in the world, and 3... for reminding us that as long as you give a nice tip, you can always use the fanciest hotel concierge in town.
And who else scored a point, Nikki?
Mark, I think I actually eked one out this time.
Mm-hmm, you did, because I love the fact that you riffed on Philippe's tip so that buying a fake Rolex means anyone can travel with a Rolex. You don't have to save up for that lifesaver.
Yeah, let's just face it. The only reason I suggested that is because I'm not saving up for a Rolex just to throw it at a thief.
Well, that was a pretty impressive tally from both of you. This has been another episode of Travel Genius. I'm Mark Elwood.
And I'm Nikki Eckstein. Do you have a favorite travel tip or hack that you'd like to share? Or maybe you've got thoughts on some of the tips that we discussed today. Either way, let us know.
You can call us on, now write this down, 646-324-3490. And maybe we'll even play your tip on the show. You can also find us on Twitter, of course. I'm at Mark J. Elwood with a K and two L's.
And I'm at Nikki Eckstein with three K's and no C's. If you're a fan of Travel Genius, please take a moment to rate and review us. It helps new listeners find us.
This episode was produced by Topher Voorhees and Francesca Levy as Bloomberg's head of podcast. Thanks for listening.